She fumbled in the pocket of her gown and drew out a long white envelope.
"You'll think me a dreadful coward," she said, "and I am. But I honestly don't think I can do it. Say goodbye to Bree, I mean."
She stopped to bring her voice under control and then held out the envelope to him.
"I wrote it all down for her. Everything I could. Will you?"
Roger took the envelope. It was warm from resting next to her body. From some obscure feeling that it mustn't be allowed to grow cold before it reached her daughter, he thrust it into his own breast pocket, feeling the crackle of paper as the envelope bent.
"Yes," he said, hearing his own voice thicken.
"Then you'll go
early," she said, taking a deep breath. "Before dawn. I've arranged for a car to pick me up."
Her hands twisted together in her lap.
"If I..."
She bit her lip, then looked at Roger pleadingly.
"I don't know, you see," she said. "I don't know whether I can do it. I'm very much afraid. Afraid to go. Afraid not to go. Just afraid."
"I would be too." He held out his hand, and she took it. He held it for a long time, feeling the pulse in her wrist light and fast against his fingers. After a long time, she squeezed his hand gently and let go.
"Thank you, Roger," she said, "for everything."
She leaned over and kissed him lightly on the lips. Then she rose and went out, a white ghost in the darkness of the hall, borne on the Halloween wind. Roger sat on for some time alone, feeling her touch still warm on his skin. The jack-o'-lantern was nearly burned out. The smell of candle wax rose strongly in the restless air, and the pagan gods looked out for the last time through eyes of guttering flame. Chapter 23. Craigna Dun. The early morning air was cold and misty, and I was glad of the cloak. It had been 20 years since I'd worn one, but with the sorts of things people wore nowadays, the Inverness tailor who'd made it for me hadn't found an order for a woollen cloak with a hood at all odd. I kept my eyes on the path. The crest of the hill had been invisible, wreathed in mist, when the car had left me on the road below.
"Here," the driver had said, peering dubiously out of his window at the deserted countryside. "Sure, mum."
"Yes," I'd said, half choked with terror. "This is the place."
"Aye."
He looked dubious, in spite of the large note I put in his hand.
"Do you want me to wait, mum, or come back later to fetch you back?"
I was sorely tempted to say yes. After all, what if I lost my nerve? At the moment, my grip on that slippery substance seemed remarkably feeble.
"No," I said, swallowing. "No, that won't be necessary."
If I couldn't do it, I would just have to walk back to Inverness, that was all. Or perhaps Roger and Brianna would come. I thought that would be worse, to be ignominiously retrieved. Or would it be a relief? The granite pebbles rolled beneath my feet, and a clod of dirt fell in a small rushing shower dislodged by my passage.
I couldn't possibly really be doing this, I thought.
The weight of the money in my reinforced pocket swung against my thigh. The heavy certainty of gold and silver, a reminder of reality. I was doing it. I couldn't. Thoughts of Bree as I had seen her late last night, peacefully asleep in her bed, assaulted me. The tendrils of remembered horror reached out from the hilltop above as I began to sense the nearness of the stones. Screaming, chaos, the feeling of being torn in pieces. I couldn't. But I kept on climbing, palms sweating, my feet moving as though no longer under my control. It was full dawn by the time I reached the top of the hill. The mist lay below, and the stones stood clear and dark against a crystal sky. The sight of them left me wet-palmed with apprehension, but I walked forward and passed into the circle. They were standing on the grass in front of the cleft stone, facing each other. Brianna heard my footsteps and whirled around to face me. I stared at her, speechless with astonishment. She was wearing a Jessica Gutenberg dress, very much like the one I had on, except that hers was a vivid lime green with plastic jewels stitched across the bosom. "That's a perfectly horrible colour for you," I said.
"It's the only one they had in a size 16," she answered calmly. "What in the name of goodness are you doing here?" I demanded, recovering some remnant of coherence. "We came to see you off," she said, and a hint of a smile flickered on her lips.
I looked at Roger, who shrugged slightly and gave me a lopsided smile of his own.
"Oh, yes.
Well," I said. The stone stood behind Brianna, twice the height of a man. I could look through the foot-wide crack and see the faint morning sun shining on the grass outside the circle.
"You're going," she said firmly, "or I am."
"You? Are you out of your mind?"
"No."
She glanced at the cleft stone and swallowed. It might have been the lime-green dress that made her face look chalk-white.
"I can do it. Go through, I mean. I know I can. When Geely Duncan went through the stones, I heard them. Roger did too."
She glanced at him as though for reassurance, then fixed her gaze firmly on me.
"I don't know whether I could find Jamie Fraser or not. Maybe only you can. But if you won't try, then I will."
My mouth opened, but I couldn't find anything to say.
"Don't you see, Mama? He has to know. Has to know he did it. He did what he meant to for us."
Her lips quivered and she pressed them together for a minute.
"We owe it to him, Mama," she said softly. "Somebody has to find him and tell him."
Her hand touched my face briefly.
"Tell him I was born."
"Oh, Bree," I said, my voice so choked I could barely speak.
"Oh, Bree."
She was holding my hands tight between her own, squeezing hard.
"He gave you to me," she said, so low I could hardly hear her. "Now I have to give you back to him, Mama."
The eyes that were so like Jamie's looked down at me, blurred by tears.
"If you find him," she whispered, "when you find my father, give him this."
She bent and kissed me, fiercely, gently, then straightened and turned me toward the stone.
"Go, Mama," she said, breathless. "I love you. Go."
From the corner of my eye, I saw Roger move toward her. I took one step, and then another. I heard a sound, a faint roaring. I took the last step, and the world disappeared.
This ends Disc 10. Voyager, Disc 11.
Part 6. Edinburgh. Chapter 24. A. Malcolm, Printer. My first coherent thought was, "It's raining. This must be Scotland." My second thought was that this observation was no great improvement over the random images jumbling around inside my head, banging into each other, and setting off small synaptic explosions of irrelevance. I opened one eye with some difficulty. The lid was stuck shut, and my entire face felt cold and puffy like a submerged corpse's. I shuddered faintly at the thought, the slight movement making me aware of the sodden fabric all around me. It was certainly raining. A soft, steady drum of rain that raised a faint mist of droplets above the green moor. I sat up, feeling like a hippopotamus emerging from a bog, and promptly fell over backward. I blinked and closed my eyes against the downpour. Some small sense of who I was and where I was beginning to come back to me. Bree! Her face emerged suddenly into memory with a jolt that made me gasp as though I'd been punched in the stomach. Jagged images of loss and the rip of separation pulled at me, a faint echo of the chaos in the stone passage. Jamie! There it was, the anchor point to which I had clung, my single hold on sanity. I breathed slow and deep, hands folded over my pounding heart, summoning Jamie's face. For a moment, I thought I had lost him. And then it came, clear and bold in my mind's eye. Once again, I struggled upright, and this time stayed, propped by my outstretched hands. Yes, certainly it was Scotland. It could hardly be anything else, of course. But it was also the Scotland of the past. At least, I hoped it was the past. It wasn't the Scotland I'd left, at any rate. The trees and bushes grew in different patterns. There was a patch of maple saplings just below me that hadn't been there when I'd climbed the hill. When? That morning? 2 days ago? I had no idea how much time had passed since I had entered the Standing Stones, or how long I had lain unconscious on the hillside below the circle. Quite a while, judging from the sogginess of my clothing. I was soaked through to the skin, and small chilly rivulets ran down my sides under my gown. One numbed cheek was beginning to tingle. Putting my hand to it, I could feel a pattern of incised bumps. I looked down and saw a layer of fallen rowan berries, gleaming red and black among the grass. Very appropriate, I thought, vaguely amused. I had fallen down under a rowan, the Highland protection against witchcraft and enchantment. I grasped the smooth trunk of the rowan tree and laboriously hauled myself to my feet. Still holding on to the tree for support, I looked to the northeast. The rain had faded the horizon to a grey invisibility, but I knew that Inverness lay in that direction, no more than an hour's trip by car along modern roads. The road existed. I could see the outline of a rough track that led along the base of the hill, a dark silvery line in the gleaming green wetness of the moor plants. However, 40-odd miles on foot was a far cry from the journey by car that had brought me here. I was beginning to feel somewhat better standing up. The weakness in my limbs was fading, along with the feeling of chaos and disruption in my mind. It had been as bad as I'd feared, this passage. Perhaps worse. I could feel the terrible presence of the stones above me, and shuddered, my skin prickling with cold. I was alive, though. Alive. And with a small feeling of certainty, like a tiny glowing sun beneath my ribs. He was here. I knew it now, though I hadn't known it when I threw myself between the stones. That had been a leap of faith. But I had cast out my thought of Jamie like a lifeline tossed into a raging torrent, and the line had tightened in my grasp and pulled me free. I was wet, cold, and felt battered, as though I had been washing about in the surf against a rocky shore. But I was here, and somewhere in this strange country of the past was the man I had come to find. The memories of grief and terror were receding as I realized that my die was cast. I couldn't go back. A return trip would almost surely be fatal. As I realized that I was likely here to stay, all hesitations and terrors were superseded by a strange calm, almost exultant. I could not go back. There was nothing to do but go forward to find him. Cursing my carelessness in not having thought to tell the tailor to make my cloak with a waterproof layer between fabric and lining, I pulled the water-soaked garment closer. Even wet, the wool held some warmth. If I began to move, I would grow warmer. A quick pat reassured me that my bundle of sandwiches had made the trip with me. That was good. The thought of walking 40 miles on an empty stomach was a daunting one.
With luck, I wouldn't have to. I might find a village or a house that had a horse I could buy. But if not, I was prepared. My plan was to go to Inverness by whatever means offered itself, and there take a public coach to Edinburgh. There was no telling where Jamie was at the moment. He might be in Edinburgh, where his article had been published, but he might easily be somewhere else. If I couldn't find him there, I could go to Lallybroch, his home. Surely his family would know where he was, if any of them were left. The sudden thought chilled me, and I shivered. I thought of a small bookstore that I passed every morning on my way from the parking lot to the hospital. They had been having a sale on posters. I had seen the display of psychedelic examples when I left Joe's office for the last time. "Today is the first day of the rest of your life," said one poster, above an illustration of a foolish-looking chick absurdly poking its head out of an eggshell. In another window, another poster showed a caterpillar inching its way up a flower stalk. Above the stalk soared a brilliantly coloured butterfly, and below was the motto, "A journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." The most irritating thing about clichés, I decided, was how frequently they were true. I let go of the rowan tree and started down the hill toward my future. It was a long, jolting ride from Inverness to Edinburgh, crammed cheek by jowl into a large coach with two other ladies, the small and whiny son of one of the ladies, and four gentlemen of varying sizes and dispositions. Mr. Graham, a small and vivacious gentleman of advanced years, who was seated next to me, was wearing a bag of camphor and asafoetida about his neck, to the eye-watering discomfort of the rest of the coach. "Capital for dispelling the evil humours of influenza," he explained to me, waving the bag gently under my nose like a censer. "I have worn this daily through the autumn and winter months, and haven't been sick a day in nearly 30 years." "Amazing," I said politely, trying to hold my breath. I didn't doubt it. The fumes probably kept everyone at such a distance that germs couldn't reach him. The effects on the little boy didn't seem nearly so beneficial. After a number of loud and injudicious remarks about the smell in the coach, Master Georgie had been muffled in his mother's bosom, from which he now peeped, looking rather green. I kept a close eye on him, as well as on the chamber pot beneath the seat opposite, in case quick action involving a conjunction of the two should be called for. I gathered that the chamber pot was for use in inclement weather or other emergency, as normally the lady's modesty required stops every hour or so, at which point the passengers would scatter into the roadside vegetation like a covey of quail, even those who didn't require relief of bladder or bowels seeking some relief from the stench of Mr. Graham's asafoetida bag. After one or two changes, Mr. Graham found his place beside me superseded by Mr. Wallace, a plump young lawyer returning to Edinburgh after seeing to the disposition of the estate of an elderly relative in Inverness, as he explained to me. I didn't find the details of his legal practice nearly as fascinating as he did, but under the circumstances, his evident attraction to me was mildly reassuring, and I passed several hours in playing with him upon a small chess set that he produced from a pocket and laid upon his knee. My attention was distracted both from the discomforts of the journey and the intricacies of chess by anticipation of what I might find in Edinburgh. A. Malcolm. The name kept running through my mind like an anthem of hope. A. Malcolm. It had to be Jamie. It simply had to. James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. Considering the way the Highland rebels were treated after Culloden, it would be very reasonable to use an assumed name in a place like Edinburgh, Roger Wakefield had explained to me. Particularly him. He was a convicted traitor, after all. Made rather a habit of it, too, it looks like, he had added critically, looking over the scrawled manuscript of the anti-tax diatribe. For the Times, this is bloody near sedition. Yes, That sounds like Jamie, I had said dryly. But my heart had leapt at the sight of that distinctively untidy scrawl with its boldly worded sentiments. My Jamie. I touched the small hard rectangle in my skirt pocket, wondering how long it would be before we reached Edinburgh. The weather kept unseasonably fine, with no more than the occasional drizzle to hinder our passage, and we completed the journey in less than 2 days, stopping 4 times to change horses and refresh ourselves at post-house taverns. The coach debouched into a yard at the back of Boyd's White Horse Tavern near the foot of the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. The passengers emerged into the watery sunshine like newly hatched chrysalids, rumpled of wing and jerky in movement, unaccustomed to mobility. After the dimness of the coach, even the cloudy grey light of Edinburgh seemed blinding. I had pins and needles in my feet from so long sitting, but hurried nonetheless, hoping to escape from the courtyard while my erstwhile companions were busy with the retrieval of their belongings. No such luck. Mr. Wallace caught up with me near the street. "Mrs. Fraser," he said, "might I beg the pleasure of accompanying you to your destination? You will surely require some assistance in the removal of your luggage." He looked over his shoulder toward the coach, where the ostlers were heaving the bags and portmanteau, apparently at random, into the crowd, to the accompaniment of incoherent grunts and shouts. I said, "Thank you, but I'm leaving my luggage in charge of the landlord. I groped frantically. "My husband's servant will come fetch it later." His plump face fell slightly at the word "husband," but he rallied gallantly, taking my hand and bowing low over it. "I quite see. May I express my profound appreciation for the pleasure of your company on our journey, then, Mrs. Fraser. And perhaps we shall meet again?" He straightened up, surveying the crowd that eddied past us. "Is your husband meeting you? I should be delighted to make his acquaintance." While Mr. Wallace's interest in me had been rather flattering, it was rapidly becoming a nuisance. "No, I shall be joining him later," I said. "So nice to have met you, Mr. Wallace. I'll hope to see you again sometime." I shook Mr. Wallace's hand enthusiastically, which disconcerted him enough for me to slither off through the throng of passengers, ostlers, and food sellers. I didn't dare pause near the coachyard for fear he would come out after me. I turned and darted up the slope of the Royal Mile, moving as quickly as my voluminous skirts would allow, jostling and bumping my way through the crowd. I had had the luck to pick a market day for my arrival, and I was soon lost to sight from the coachyard among the luckin booths and oyster sellers who lined the street. Panting like an escaped pickpocket, I stopped for breath halfway up the hill. There was a public fountain here, and I sat down on the rim to catch my breath. I was here, really here. Edinburgh sloped up behind me to the glowering heights of Edinburgh Castle, and down before me to the gracious majesty of Holyrood Palace at the foot of the city. The last time I had stood by this fountain, Bonnie Prince Charlie had been addressing the gathered citizenry of Edinburgh, inspiring them with the sight of his royal presence. He had bounded exuberantly from the rim to the carved centre finial of the fountain, 1 foot in the basin, clinging to one of the spouting heads for support, shouting, "On to England!" The crowd had roared, pleased at this show of youthful high spirits and athletic prowess. I would myself have been more impressed had I not noticed that the water in the fountain had been turned off in anticipation of the gesture. I wondered where Charlie was now. He had gone back to Italy after Culloden, I suppose, there to live whatever life was possible for royalty in permanent exile. What he was doing, I neither knew nor cared. He had passed from the pages of history, and from my life as well, leaving rack and ruin in his wake. It remained to be seen what might be salvaged now. I was very hungry. I had had nothing to eat since a hasty breakfast of rough porridge and boiled mutton,
made soon after dawn at a post house in Dundaff. I had one last sandwich remaining in my pocket, but had been reluctant to eat it in the coach under the curious gaze of my fellow travellers. I pulled it out and carefully unwrapped it. Peanut butter and jelly on white bread. It was considerably the worse for wear, with the purple stains of the jelly seeping through the limp bread, and the whole thing mashed into a flattened wodge. It was delicious. I ate it carefully, savouring the rich, oily taste of the peanut butter. How many mornings had I slathered peanut butter on bread, making sandwiches for Brianna's school lunches? Firmly suppressing the thought, I examined the passers-by for destruction. They did look somewhat different from their modern equivalents. Both men and women tended to be shorter, and the signs of poor nutrition were evident. Still, there was an overwhelming familiarity to them. These were people I knew, Scots and English for the most part, and hearing the rich, burring babble of voices in the street after so many years of the flat nasal tones of Boston, I had quite an extraordinary feeling of coming home. I swallowed the last rich, sweet bite of my old life and crumpled the wrapper in my hand. I glanced around, but no one was looking in my direction. I opened my hand and let the bit of plastic film fall surreptitiously to the ground. Wadded up, it rolled a few inches on the cobbles, crinkling and unfolding itself as though alive. The light wind caught it, and the small transparent sheet took sudden wing, scudding over the grey stones like a leaf. The draught of a set of passing wheels sucked it under a drayman's cart. It winked once with reflected light and was gone, disappearing without notice from the passers-by. I wondered whether my own anachronistic presence would cause as little harm. "You are dithering, Beecham," I said to myself. "Time to get on." I took a deep breath and stood up. "Excuse me," I said, catching the sleeve of a passing baker's boy. "I'm looking for a printer, a Mr. Malcolm, Alexander Malcolm." A feeling of mingled dread and excitement gurgled through my middle. What if there was no print shop run by Alexander Malcolm in Edinburgh? There was, though. The boy's face screwed up in thought and then relaxed. "Oh, aye, mum. Just down the way and to your left. Carfax Close." And hitching his loaves up under his arm with a nod, he plunged back into the crowded street. Carfax Close. I edged my way back into the crowd, pressing close to the buildings to avoid the occasional shower of slops that splattered into the street from the windows high above. There were several thousand people in Edinburgh, and the sewage from all of them was running down the gutters of the cobbled street, depending on gravity and the frequent rain to keep the city habitable. The low, dark opening to Carfax Close yawned just ahead, across the expanse of the Royal Mile. I stopped dead, looking at it, my heart beating hard enough to be heard a yard away, had anyone been listening. It wasn't raining, but was just about to, and the dampness in the air made my hair curl. I pushed it off my forehead, tidying it as best I could without a mirror. Then I caught sight of a large plate-glass window up ahead and hurried forward. The glass was misty with condensation, but provided a dim reflection, in which my face looked flushed and wide-eyed, but otherwise presentable. My hair, however, had seized the opportunity to curl madly in all directions, and was writhing out of its hairpins in excellent imitation of Medusa's locks. I yanked the pins out impatiently and began to twist up my curls. There was a woman inside the shop, leaning across the counter. There were three small children with her, and I watched with half an eye as she turned from her business to address them impatiently, swatting with her reticule at the middle one, a boy who was fiddling with several stalks of fresh anise that stood in a pail of water on the floor. It was an apothecary's shop. Glancing up, I saw the name Haw above the door and felt a thrill of recognition. I had bought herbs here during the brief time I had lived in Edinburgh,
The decor of the window had been augmented some time since by the addition of a large jar of coloured water, in which floated something vaguely humanoid. A fetal pig, or perhaps an infant baboon. It had leering, flattened features that pressed against the rounded side of the jar in a disconcerting fashion. "Well, at least I look better than you," I muttered, shoving in a recalcitrant pin. I looked better than the woman inside, too, I thought. Her business concluded, she was stuffing her purchase into the bag she carried, her thin face frowning as she did so. She had the rather pasty look of a city dweller, and her skin was deeply lined, with sharp creases running from nose to mouth, and a furrowed forehead. "Deal tak ye, you wee ratten," she was saying crossly to the little boy as they all clattered out of the shop together. "Have I no told you time and time again to keep your paws in your pockets?" "Excuse me?" I stepped forward, interrupting, impelled by a sudden, irresistible curiosity. "Aye?" Distracted from maternal remonstration, she looked blankly at me. Up close, she looked even more harried. The corners of her mouth were pinched, and her lips folded in, no doubt because of missing teeth. "I couldn't help admiring your children," I said, with as much pretense of admiration as I could manage on short notice. I beamed kindly at them. "Such pretty babies. Tell me, how old are they?" Her jaw dropped, confirming the absence of several teeth. She blinked at me, then said, "Oh, well, that's meest kind of you, Mum. Mesri here is 10, she said, nodding at the eldest girl, who was in the act of wiping her nose on her sleeve. "Joey's 8. Take your fingers out of your nose, you clatty imp," she hissed, then turned and proudly patted her youngest on the head. "And wee Polly's just turned 6 as me." "Really?" I gazed at the woman, affecting astonishment. "You scarcely look old enough to have children of that age. You must have married very young." She preened slightly, smirking. "Oh, no, not so young as all that. Why, I was all of 19 when Mesri was born." "Amazing," I said, meaning it. I dug in my pocket and offered the children each a penny, which they took with shy bobs of thanks. "Good day to you, and congratulations on your lovely family," I said to the woman, and walked away with a smile and a wave. 19 when the eldest was born, and Mesri was 10 now. She was 29, and I, blessed by good nutrition, hygiene, and dentistry, not worn down by multiple pregnancies and hard physical labour, looked a good deal younger than she. I took a deep breath, pushed back my hair, and marched into the shadows of Carfax Close. It was a longish, winding close, and the print shop was at the foot. There were thriving businesses and tenements on either side, but I had no attention to spare for anything beyond the neat white sign that hung by the door. "A. Malcolm, printer and bookseller," it said. And beneath this, "Books, calling cards, pamphlets, broadsheets, letters, etc." I stretched out my hand and touched the black letters of the name. "A. Malcolm, Alexander Malcolm, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. Perhaps." Another minute and I would lose my nerve. I shoved open the door and walked in. There was a broad counter across the front of the room with an open flap in it and a rack to one side that held several trays of type. Posters and notices of all sorts were tacked up on the opposite wall, samples no doubt. The door into the back room was open, showing the bulky angular frame of a printing press. Bent over it, his back turned to me, was Jamie.
"Is that you, Geordie?" he asked, not turning around.
He was dressed in shirt and breeches, and had a small tool of some kind in his hand, with which he was doing something to the innards of the press.
"Took you long enough. Did you get the..."
"It isn't Geordie," I said. My voice was higher than usual. "It's me," I said. "Claire." He straightened up very slowly. He wore his hair long, a thick tail of a deep, rich auburn sparked with copper. I had time to see that the neat ribbon that tied it back was green. And then he turned around. He stared at me without speaking. A tremor ran down the muscular throat as he swallowed, but still he didn't say anything. It was the same broad, good-humoured face, dark blue eyes aslant the high, flat cheekbones of a Viking, long mouth curling at the ends as though always on the verge of smiling. The lines surrounding the eyes and mouth were deeper, of course. The nose had changed just a bit. The knife-edge bridge was slightly thickened near the base by the ridge of an old healed scar. It made him look fiercer, I thought, but lessened that air of aloof reserve, and lent his appearance a new rough charm. I walked through the flap in the counter, seeing nothing but that unblinking stare. I cleared my throat. "When did you break your nose?" The corners of the wide mouth lifted slightly.
"About 3 minutes after I last saw you. Sassenach."
There was a hesitation, almost a question in the name. There was no more than a foot between us. I reached out tentatively and touched the tiny line of the break where the bone pressed white against the bronze of his skin. He flinched backward as though an electric spark had arced between us, and the calm expression shattered.
"You're real," he whispered.
I had thought him pale already. Now all vestiges of colour drained from his face. His eyes rolled up, and he slumped to the floor in a shower of papers and oddments that had been sitting on the press. He fell rather gracefully for such a large man, I thought abstractedly. It was only a feint. His eyelids were beginning to flutter by the time I knelt beside him and loosened the stock at his throat. I had no doubts at all by now, but still I looked automatically as I pulled the heavy linen away. It was there, of course, the small triangular scar just above the collarbone, left by the knife of Captain Jonathan Randall, Esquire, of His Majesty's 8th Dragoons. His normal healthy colour was returning. I sat cross-legged on the floor and hoisted his head onto my thigh. His hair felt thick and soft in my hand. His eyes opened. "That bad, is it?" I said, smiling down at him with the same words he had used to me on the day of our wedding, holding my head in his lap 20-odd years before.
"That bad, and worse, Sassenach," he answered,
mouth twitching with something almost a smile. He sat up abruptly, staring at me.
"God in heaven, you are real."
"So are you." I lifted my chin to look up at him. "I thought you were dead." I had meant to speak lightly, but my voice betrayed me. The tears spilled down my cheeks, only to soak into the rough cloth of his shirt as he pulled me hard against him. I shook so that it was some time before I realized that he was shaking too, and for the same reason. I don't know how long we sat there on the dusty floor, crying in each other's arms with the longing of 20 years spilling down our faces. His fingers twined hard in my hair, pulling it loose so that it tumbled down my neck. The dislodged pins cascaded over my shoulders and pinged on the floor like pellets of hail. My own fingers were clasped around his forearm, digging into the linen, as though I were afraid he would disappear unless physically restrained. As though gripped by the same fear, he suddenly grasped me by the shoulders and held me away from him, staring desperately into my face. He put his hand to my cheek and traced the bones over and over again, oblivious to my tears and to my abundantly running nose. I sniffed loudly, which seemed to bring him to his senses, for he let go and groped hastily in his sleeve for a handkerchief, which he used clumsily to swab first my face, then his own.
"Give me that!"
I grabbed the erratically waving swatch of cloth and blew my nose firmly. "Now you!" I handed him the cloth
and watched as he blew his nose with a noise like a strangled goose. I giggled, undone with emotion. He smiled too, knuckling the tears away from his eyes, unable to stop staring at me. Suddenly, I couldn't bear not to be touching him. I lunged at him, and he got his arms up just in time to catch me. I squeezed until I could hear his ribs crack and felt his hands roughly caressing my back as he said my name over and over. At last, I could let go and sat back a little. He glanced down at the floor between his legs, frowning. "Did you lose something?" I asked, surprised. He looked up and smiled, a little shyly.
"I was afraid I'd lost hold altogether and pissed myself. But it's all right. I've just sat on the ale pot."
Sure enough, a pool of aromatic brown liquid was spreading slowly beneath him. With a squeak of alarm, I scrambled to my feet and helped him up. After trying vainly to assess the damage behind, he shrugged and unfastened his breeches. He pushed the tight fabric down over his haunches, then stopped and looked at me, blushing slightly. "It's all right," I said, feeling a rich blush stain my own cheeks. "We're married." I cast my eyes down, nonetheless, feeling a little breathless. "At least, I suppose we are." He stared at me for a long moment. Then a smile curved his wide, soft mouth.
"Aye, we are," he said.
Kicking free of the stained breeches, he stepped toward me. I stretched out a hand toward him, as much to stop as to welcome him. I wanted more than anything to touch him again, but was unaccountably shy. After so long, how were we to start again? He felt the constraint of mingled shyness and intimacy as well. Stopping a few inches from me, he took my hand. He hesitated for a moment, then bent his head over it, his lips barely brushing my knuckles. His fingers touched the silver ring and stopped there, holding the metal lightly between thumb and forefinger. "I never took it off," I blurted. It seemed important he should know that. He squeezed my hand lightly, but didn't let go.
"I want..."
He stopped and swallowed, still holding my hand. His fingers found and touched the silver ring once more.
"I want very much to kiss you," he said softly. "May I do that?"
The tears were barely dammed. Two more welled up and overflowed. I felt them, full and round, roll down my cheeks. "Yes," I whispered. He drew me slowly close to him, holding our linked hands just under his breast.
"I haven't done this for a very long time," he said.
I saw the hope and the fear dark in the blue of his eyes. I took the gift and gave it back to him.
"Neither have I,"
I said softly.
His hands cupped my face with exquisite gentleness, and he set his mouth on mine. I didn't quite know what I'd been expecting. A reprise of the pounding fury that had accompanied our final parting. I had remembered that so often, lived it over in memory, helpless to change the outcome. The half-rough, timeless hours of mutual possession in the darkness of our marriage bed. I had longed for that, wakened often, sweating and trembling from the memory of it. But we were strangers now, barely touching, each seeking the way toward joining, slowly, tentatively, seeking and giving unspoken permission with our silent lips. My eyes were closed, and I knew without looking that Jamie's were as well. We were, quite simply, afraid to look at each other. Without raising his head, he began to stroke me lightly, feeling my bones through my clothes, familiarizing himself again with the terrain of my body. At last, his hand traveled down my arm and caught my right hand.
His fingers traced my hand until they found the ring again and circled it, feeling the interlaced silver of the Highland pattern, polished with long wear, but still distinct. His lips moved from mine, across my cheeks and eyes. I gently stroked his back, feeling through his shirt the marks I couldn't see, the remnants of old scars, like my ring, worn but still distinct.
"I've seen you so many times," he said, his voice whispering warm in my ear. "You've come to me so often, when I dream sometimes, when I lay in fever, when I was so afraid and so lonely I knew I must die. When I needed you, I would always see you smiling with your hair curling up about your face. But you never spoke, and you never touched me."
"I can touch you now." I reached up and drew my hand gently down his temple, his ear, the cheek and jaw that I could see. My hand went to the nape of his neck under the clubbed bronze hair, and he raised his head at last and cupped my face between his hands, love glowing strong in the dark blue eyes.
"Dinna be afraid," he said softly. "There's the two of us now."
We might have gone on standing there, gazing at each other indefinitely, had the shop bell over the door not rung. I let go of Jamie and looked around sharply to see a small, wiry man with coarse dark hair standing in the door, mouth agape, holding a small parcel in one hand.
"Oh, there you are, Geordie. What's kept you?" Jamie said.
Geordie said nothing, but his eyes travelled dubiously over his employer, standing bare-legged in his shirt in the middle of the shop, his breeches, shoes and stockings discarded on the floor, and me in his arms, with my gown all crumpled and my hair coming down. Geordie's narrow face creased into a censorious frown.
"I quit," he said, in the rich tones of the West Highlands. "The printing's one thing. I'm wi' you there, and you'll no think otherwise. But I'm free kirk, and my daddy before me, and my grandsire before him. Working for a papist is one thing. The Pope's coin's as good as any, aye? But working for an immoral papist is another. Do as you like wi' your own soul, man. But if it's come to orgies in the shop, it's come too far. That's what I say. I quit."
He placed the package precisely in the centre of the counter, spun on his heel, and stalked toward the door. Outside, the town clock on the toll booth began to strike. Geordie turned in the doorway to glare accusingly at us.
"And it not even noon yet," he said.
The shop door slammed behind him. Jamie stared after him for a moment, then sank slowly down onto the floor again, laughing so hard the tears came to his eyes.
"And it's not even noon yet," he repeated, wiping the tears off his cheeks. "Oh, God, Geordie!"
He rocked back and forth, grasping his knees with both hands. I couldn't help laughing myself, though I was rather worried.
"I didn't mean to cause you trouble," I said.
"Will he come back, do you think?" He sniffed and wiped his face carelessly on the tail of his shirt.
"Oh, aye. He lives just across the way in Wickham Wynd. I'll go see him in a bit and explain," he said.
He looked at me, realisation dawning, and added,
"God knows how."
It looked for a minute as though he might start laughing again, but he mastered the impulse and stood up. "Have you got another pair of breeches?" I asked, picking up the discarded ones and draping them across the counter to dry.
"Aye. I have. Upstairs. Wait a bit, though."
He snaked a long arm into the cupboard beneath the counter and came out with a neatly lettered notice that said, "Gone out." Attaching this to the outside of the door and firmly bolting the inside, he turned to me.
"Will you step upstairs with me?" he said.
He crooked an arm invitingly, eyes sparkling.
"If you dinna think it immoral."
"Why not?" I said. The impulse to explode in laughter was just below the surface, sparkling in my blood like champagne. "We're married, aren't we?" The upstairs was divided into two rooms,
one on either side of the landing, and a small privy closet just off the landing itself. The back room was plainly devoted to storage for the printing business. The door was propped open, and I could see wooden crates filled with books, towering bundles of pamphlets neatly tied with twine, barrels of alcohol and powdered ink, and a jumble of odd-looking hardware that I assumed must be spare parts for a printing press. The front room was spare as a monk's cell. There was a chest of drawers with a pottery candlestick on it, a washstand, a stool, and a narrow cot, little more than a camp bed. I let out my breath when I saw it, only then realizing that I had been holding it. He slept alone. A quick glance around confirmed that there was no sign of a feminine presence in the room, and my heart began to beat with a normal rhythm again. Plainly, no one lived here but Jamie. He had pushed aside the curtain that blocked off a corner of the room, and the row of pegs revealed there supported no more than a couple of shirts, a coat, and a long waistcoat in sober grey, a grey wool cloak, and the spare pair of breeches he had come to fetch. He had his back turned to me as he tucked in his shirt and fastened the new breeches, but I could see the self-consciousness in the tense line of his shoulders. I could feel a similar tension in the back of my own neck. Given a moment to recover from the shock of seeing each other, we were both stricken now with shyness. I saw his shoulders straighten, and then he turned around to face me. The hysterical laughter had left us, and the tears, though his face still showed the marks of so much sudden feeling, and I knew mine did too.
"It's very fine to see you, Claire," he said softly. "I thought I never... well..."
He shrugged slightly, as though to ease the tightness of the linen shirt across his shoulders. He swallowed, then met my eyes directly.
"The child?" he said.
Everything he felt was evident on his face. Urgent hope, desperate fear, and the struggle to contain both. I smiled at him and put out my hand. "Come here." I had thought long and hard about what I might bring with me should my journey through the stones succeed. Given my previous brush with accusations of witchcraft, I had been very careful. But there was one thing I had to bring, no matter what the consequences might be if anyone saw them. I pulled him down to sit beside me on the cot, and pulled out of my pocket the small rectangular package I had done up with such care in Boston. I undid its waterproof wrapping and thrust its contents into his hands. "There," I said. He took them from me gingerly, like one handling an unknown and possibly dangerous substance. His big hands framed the photographs for a moment, holding them confined. Brianna's round, newborn face was oblivious between his fingers, tiny fists curled on her blanket, slanted eyes closed in the new exhaustion of existence, her small mouth slightly open in sleep. I looked up at his face. It was absolutely blank with shock. He held the pictures close to his chest, unmoving, wide-eyed and staring as though he had just been transfixed by a crossbow bolt through the heart, as I supposed he had. "Your daughter sent you this," I said. I turned his blank face toward me and gently kissed him on the mouth. That broke the trance. He blinked, and his face came to life again.
"My... she..."
His voice was hoarse with shock.
"Daughter? My daughter? She knows?"
"She does. Look at the rest." I slid the first picture from his grasp, revealing the snapshot of Brianna, uproariously festooned with the icing of her first birthday cake, a four-toothed smile of fiendish triumph on her face as she waved a new plush rabbit overhead. Jamie made a small, inarticulate sound, and his fingers loosened. I took the small stack of photographs from him and gave them back, one at a time. Brianna, at two, stubby in her snowsuit, cheeks round and flushed as apples, feathery hair wisping from under her hood. Bree at four, hair a smooth, bell-shaped gleam as she sat, one ankle propped on the opposite knee, as she smiled for the photographer, proper and poised in a white pinafore. At 5, in proud possession of her first lunchbox, waiting to board the school bus to kindergarten. She wouldn't let me go with her. She wanted to go alone. She's very brave, not afraid of anything. I felt half-choked as I explained, displayed, pointed to the changing images that fell from his hands and slid down to the floor as he began to snatch at each new picture. "Oh, God," he said, at the picture of Bree at 10, sitting on the kitchen floor with her arms around Smokey, the big Newfoundland. That one was in colour, her hair a brilliant shimmer against the dog's shiny black coat. His hands were shaking so badly that he couldn't hold the pictures any more. I had to show him the last few. Bree, full grown, laughing at a string of fish she'd caught. Standing at a window in secretive contemplation, red-faced and tousled, leaning on the handle of the axe she had been using to split kindling. These showed her face in all the moods I could capture. Always that face, long-nosed and wide-mouthed, with those high, broad, flat Viking cheekbones and slanted eyes. A finer-boned, more delicate version of her father's, of the man who sat on the cot beside me, mouth working wordlessly, and the tears running soundless down his own cheeks. He splayed a hand out over the photographs, trembling fingers not quite touching the shiny surfaces. And then he turned and leaned toward me, slowly, with the improbable grace of a tall tree falling. He buried his face in my shoulder and went very quietly and thoroughly to pieces. I held him to my breast, arms tight around the broad, shaking shoulders, and my own tears fell on his hair, making small, dark patches in the ruddy waves. I pressed my cheek against the top of his head and murmured small, incoherent things to him, as though he were Brianna. I thought to myself that perhaps it was like surgery. Even when an operation is done to repair existing damage, the healing still is painful.
Her name...
He raised his face at last, wiping his nose on the back of his hand. He picked up the pictures again, gently, as though they might disintegrate at his touch.
"What did you name her?"
"Brianna," I said proudly.
"Brianna," he said, frowning at the pictures. "What an awful name for a wee lassie."
I started back as though struck. "It's not awful," I snapped. "It's a beautiful name. And besides, you told me to name her that. What do you mean it's an awful name?"
"I told you to name her that," he blinked.
"You most certainly did. The last time I saw you..." I pressed my lips tightly together so I wouldn't cry again. After a moment, I had mastered my feelings enough to add, "You told me to name the baby for your father. His name was Brian, wasn't it?"
"Aye. It was."
A smile seemed to be struggling for dominance of the other emotions on his face.
"Aye," he said. "Aye, you're right, I did. It's only... well, I thought it would be a boy, is all."
"And you're sorry she wasn't?" I glared at him and began snatching up the scattered photographs. His hands on my arms stopped me.
"No," he said. "No, I'm not sorry. Of course not."
His mouth twitched slightly.
"But I will not deny she's a hell of a shock, Sassenach. So are you."
I sat still for a moment, looking at him. I had had months to prepare myself for this, and still my knees felt weak and my stomach was clenched in knots. He had been taken completely unawares by my appearance. Little wonder if he was reeling a bit under the impact.
"I expect I am."
"Are you sorry I came?" I asked. I swallowed. Do you want me to go?" His hands clamped my arms so tightly that I let out a small yelp. Realizing that he was hurting me, he loosened his grip, but kept a firm hold nonetheless. His face had gone quite pale at the suggestion. He took a deep breath and let it out.
No, he said, with an approximation of calmness. I don't. I...